Have a look at this one. We've got the forum. The forum allows you to post messages, post new topics without being authenticated. So that's nice. That's useful. Hold on, let me see. So, okay. I didn't see the green bar bouncing on the recording. So it allows us to post something anonymously. So I just did a little one here just to see what's going on. the first one. And then I did a scan of it and realized that it's not scanning for, it doesn't have an active scan policy set up for CSERF. So not a huge deal, but that's why I ended up with some extra post here. But let's look in Zap. So this was the post, right? You had to get the page, get the form, and then the post was you actually submitting. And you can see that there's all this post payload. Username equal, well, nothing, right? So doesn't matter. At least for an anonymous person, doesn't matter that it's not set. We've got subject equal CSERFing for this one, some BB code action, right? We've got message, and this is what's the actual message is, and this is the URL encoded. It says mode equal new topic, F equal one, and post equal submit, right? So not sure what all of that is, and all of it might not be necessary, but we can do generate anti-CSERF test form. This will open up a browser with a beautiful form here, a beautiful form. Yeah, that's a looker right there. So let's just say testing submission, right? So to see if, now I haven't authenticated or anything, I'm just seeing if it is truly predictable, right? Can I just resubmit exactly what was submitted previously and have it work? I'm not authenticated. Looks like so. Looks like it did. Let's just make sure. And it says post subject testing submission. So we made a little change and it does look like it actually sent something. Now, what I did was I put in a URL for http://192.168:1234 CSERF HTML. So I took, I took this and just saved it, and opening it up in gedit, I don't remember if that's how we tell you to edit it, but opening it up in gedit after you've saved it as HTML makes it a little easier because then it's color-coded. Now, in truth, you don't need to make any changes. We just verified you don't need to make any changes for the submission to work. I have made one change. Well, I made some changes just as spacing, but this is the only real content change I made. In the body tag, I added in this little action, onload equal F1.submit. So what is that? Well, it's this form is F1. So that's my identifying of the form. And then I'm saying, and I want you to use the submit method. So I want it to actually submit. I also changed the value on the subject, right? So now what I put in for mine was pointing them at 192.168.1.8 and CSERF HTML. So I need to host this page. CSERF.html is what I've called it, and I need to host this page. Well, I'm just using a simple HTTP server, so I saved it on my desktop, and I'm using simple HTTP server, and then I'm giving it an alternate port, so 1234. Okay. Well, now I want someone to have been logged in. There's my testing submission. I want someone to be logged in and to click this link, right? So the idea being that I'm in my post, I'm socially engineering them. Oh my gosh, this is the coolest thing ever. Have you seen this? Whatever, right? So we want to log in. Sec 542, sans user. Okay. Log in. Let's go to this test forum. oh my gosh, look at this awesome thing here. Yeah. So let's open up this link. Oh, that's nice. Now we've got a lovely subject of moo hoo 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 ha 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 ha, right? Over and over and over again. But notice the real trick here. The really important part is that it doesn't say guest, it says sec 542. Just submitting something isn't enough, right? Just submitting the transaction, we need to actually ride the session. And the fact that it shows the sec 542 is showing that it is actually riding the session. So it picked it up and said, hey, wait a second, you're actively authenticated. And the submit actually would have come through, right? The submit actually would have come through as that user, right? So see, it's coming through with this PHPBB cookie that's automatically appended when it did this post, right? Because the browser says, I've got an active session, and it automatically appends that in the request. It's just part of it. So that's how it's writing the session, is because of that piece of it. The automation, right? Again, the only thing that I did, I mean, this is just nothing, right? All that it is this. Now, that does add a scripting element, right? A little onload event handler. But all that did was make it so that they didn't really see my form and have to click submit. So anyone hitting this is now going to have that be the case, right? And of course, what they're submitting is, again, a link back to my evil page. So idea being, this will now spread like wildfire. So yeah, it was me. I social engineered one person, and then they're going to post, and they're going to post, and they're going to post, and there's going to be everyone posting the same sort of message, and hopefully it will get more people doing this. Now, in truth, we haven't really weaponized it. This is proof of concept, but it's a powerful proof of concept, showing that, you know, we now got someone to submit something under their username, under their account, that they didn't intend to, which is kind of awesome. All right, so let's move on now to our logic attacks. Logic attacks, this is a separate and distinct class of attacks that is difficult from an automation standpoint to deal with. The idea of a logic attack is that we're not really, it's not an input flaw, it's not an inject flaw necessarily. We are subverting the normal expected logic of the application. So the classic example that's used for this is e-commerce, where we take the normal flow for checkout, and then we subvert it. So the idea being that most developers, most applications are written with people stepping through in the expected flow, the expected process. And this is especially true with things like Ajax, where you just don't believe that they really have much of any control over it, where it's something that it's the rendered view, and the only thing that's exposed to them, they can't even see these resources. You can't see the button to check out. You can't see the button to submit your credit card transaction until you've actually navigated through, you know, through the precursor steps, right? So they can't even, it's often not even conceived of that someone could submit things in this out of sequence order. But of course, we're not your normal users. We're going through a proxy. We're seeing all of these details. We're seeing that, you know, Ajax is flowing through and submitting an XML HTTP request. We're seeing what's actually being submitted, and we decide, you know what? I don't really think that I want to authorize my credit card when I've got all this crap in my shopping cart. I'd like to authorize it before I have anything, and then I'd like to add stuff to my shopping cart. And wait, what? That doesn't even make sense when you think through it. But if there's not protections against those sorts of logic flaws, then this really might be possible. So that's one example. It's not by any means the only example, but that's one example of a logic attack. These are challenging attacks for most folks to discover because, well, it's kind of manual, isn't it? Right? It's not something that's easy to automatically discover. So it's us coming up with ideas of how to subvert the expected functionality of the application. So looking for any of these multi-path or multi-stage transactions and trying to do them in out-of-order fashion, that's one technique. And there's a number, it's your imagination that guides how you go after these types of attacks. But they are usually difficult to discover. They're often even more difficult to actually fix. So we're going to let you play with one. We're going to let you play with or try to figure out a logic attack. And this is the mobile man in the middle lab that I've made mention of a few times. We've got a mobile banking application, and there's a fair amount of setup for this lab, so do pay attention. This is a mobile banking application. You're going to be using the Android emulator. This Android emulator can be slow to start, so, you know, hey, you're running it inside of a VM, so there's that. You're going to be proxying this mobile banking application. The mobile banking application talks to a banking server. It actually talks to it over SSL. So this is, in fact, not just mobile man in the middle, but it's also an SSL man in the middle attack. You're going to use burp to proxy and do an SSL man in the middle, but also proxy the communications that are coming from the mobile banking app on the way to the server. And you're stepping in the middle of this, and you're going to mess with it. Now, we are cracking open SSL. We're cracking open SSL. We are stepping in as a man in the middle. So rather than letting them talk to and negotiate fully the SSL transaction all the way to the banking server, the mobile application is actually going to see burp certificate, right? So it's proxied. So mobile app talks to burp certificate. Burp then has separate SSL connection on the back end to the bank. So if the mobile application knows in advance what to expect as its certificate, because it is built to only really talk to this banking back end. And this is why we see that certificate pinning is much more commonly used here, where it can say, hey, wait a second, I know what the certificate is supposed to look like because this is my own organization. This is the mobile client that is only associated with my banking server. Certificate pinning says, hey, wait a second, I know what this is supposed to look like, and I will fail, I will not work if you try to present me anything else. This is becoming somewhat more common. It's becoming more common with applications, and in particular, you do see this with more regularity in mobile applications, where they will just die if you try to SSL man in the middle of them. Hilariously, some of them will allow you to do an SSL strip attack, though, which is just, I mean, really? Come on now. Okay, SSL strip says, I'm just going to not make it SSL at all. So if it is SSL, you force it to be the certificate, but if it's not SSL at all, you're like, dude, it's okay, whatever. No worries here, right? That's just kind of lame. So your goal, your overall goal is you're going to steal money. Okay, you've got an account, and you're going to steal money from your friends. You call them your friends, you know, whatever. So you have got a debit and a credit account. You've got the mobile application, the mobile client, and Android emulator. You're going through burp proxy on your way to the actual banking server. So here we go. Here's some of your setup. This first piece, this is just going to reset your network interface. It's probably not required, but good idea to go ahead and run it just to make sure if you've lost your IP addresses, if you don't have the extra interfaces, you need this. If anybody has messed with burp's proxy, then it will also break because we're using a different proxy setup in burp than we have been before because we're doing that SSL man in the middle and we're automatically redirecting. So sudo config static, kick burp off. Now in a terminal, type bank server. In a different terminal, then type Android. These are just little shell scripts that will kick off. But bank server and Android need to be running all the time. If you kill either of them, then, well, this ain't going to work so well. So one terminal, you got bank server running. Another terminal, you got Android running. And then, of course, you have Burp already running before that. So it's going to look like a phone. You're going to see this little lock. You are going to click and slide, right? Your finger might work for some of you, right? Some of you got some fancy displays. I don't know how well that'll work in the VM. You can tell me. But you're going to click on the lock and slide it to the right to unlock it. And then you're going to see the launcher. It looks like just a grid of squares. Okay? It's at the bottom. Hit the grid of squares. And then you're going to see Base Android Labs. So click on that. Do not enter a password. What it's doing is it's prompting you to change your password. Don't do it. Leave blank right there so that you're not changing your password. Leave it as is. So it's got cache credentials. You just hit login. Do not enter a password if ever you are asked to change it. Don't enter one or, well, you can cause some issues. Okay? Some heads up. So this is what it's going to look like once you've hit the bank. You've got three options: accounts, statement, transfer. Over here on the right, you've got the home button, the little house, takes you back to the very beginning where you'd have to click launcher again and all that stuff. Menu, don't go near here, right? This is how you can change things in the banking application. You can, though, you will use the back button, right? It will go back one menu item, so the little arrow going back, okay? All right. So check your balances, go to accounts, and check your balances. You've got a debit account, you've got a credit account. Debit account begins with a 1, credit account begins with a 2. Click the back arrow and now go to transfer. It allows you to transfer money. The intent is to transfer money between your accounts. So you can go from your debit account to your credit account, right? You can go from your credit account to your debit account. So you can move the money back and forth. But it's a drop down, so you can only move between those two from the interface. So transfer $100 from your debit account to your credit account. Press transfer, return to accounts. So use your little back buttons and all that stuff. Return to accounts and verify that it was successful. So you should have $100 less in one and $100 more in another. Yeah, that means success. Now you've done all this through Burp. So you should be able to see in Burp what's going on. This is under 192.168.1.8. Okay. And you should see under transfer, you should see the actual request. All right? So your challenge. Okay, that's all set up. Now your challenge is you got some friends, Ford Prefect, F Prefect. That's Prefect, not perfect. Okay, Prefect, not perfect. And Marvin, they've got accounts. They each have $1,000 in debit and $500 in credit. You don't know their account numbers, but you know your account numbers, and you know that there's not that many customers of this bank, so we'll just leave it at that. So you need to infer their account numbers, and those are your account numbers. And you need to use Burp Intercept to alter the transfer request to steal $3,000 from them. So you got to steal money from their accounts and put it in yours, not theirs, right? Okay, so don't give them money. Okay, you're going to steal $3,000 from both of them. There's also, that's not really a logic attack. There's also a logic flaw that you can exploit to become a millionaire. Okay, yep. So there's a logic flaw that allows you to become a millionaire, and see if you can figure out what that logic flaw is. Okay, so you can stop here, do the challenges, try to figure it out on your own. You can also, of course, flip the page and do the step-by-step walkthrough. Your first goal, become a 3,000-aire. Your next goal is to become a millionaire, a billionaire, a trillionaire. At some point, you can make it so that you will keep getting more money, but the application will fail, right? So there is an upper limit. It will go scientific notation on you for a while, but at some point it will just quit being able to render. So I don't know how many zeros you get at the end of it by that point. Since you are or you will likely be using Intercept, Please note that the application, Android expects the response to come in a timely fashion. And if you've submitted something and it's just hanging out in Burp and you're thinking about it and you're not making changes to it, Android might come up as if it will give you the option of wait or force close. Just hit wait. You're the problem. It's not the application. If you hit forward, then it will come back and be responsive again. So don't force close the application just because you won't allow it to work, right? So just a heads up there. Let's have a quick look at this. So you were playing with this mobile application, and you've got an existing account. You're doing this through Burp, right? And we talked this setup pretty well, at least I hope we did. I've logged into the application. I can move around, okay? So I hit my accounts, and you saw, while I did it, it shows me the session key. Now, the session key, it times out, right? And you saw this while you're interacting with it, that it would all of a sudden prompt you with that blank password field and the login button, and you had to submit login again, right? Well, that limited, potentially, your ability to use something like Intruder against this, right? So you'd time out, and you'd have to resubmit. Just a heads up there. We had you do it with Intercept. Did anybody do it with Repeater? Anybody try to do it with Repeater? Did it work? Yeah, for a limited amount of time, right? But you had the same issue of timing out. Now, what types of responses were you getting? Like for your accounts, what were the responses coming back as? JSON, right? Looks like some JSON coming back here. So you'd see these requests and responses. You also noticed on transfer, it comes back with success or sometimes not success, right? So let's try this out. Let me do a recent transfer. So let me go. I'm going to transfer. Okay, I'm going to transfer $1. I'm cheap. Okay, done. Transfer $1. All right. It says transfer was completed. So let's see. We've got, hey, give it to me. Why aren't you showing it in here? Okay. I just transferred some money, buddy. All right, well, I'll have to cheat. Mine's laughing at me. What did I just do? Get over there. So that is not the right transfer. It apparently didn't pop up with the latest and greatest version of the transfer, because that's an old session key for me. So let me hit my proxy history. It should show up there. Yeah, there it is. I don't know why it's not showing up in my sitemap. So there's my most recent proxy history shows my session key on the request. This is my session key. So let me copy and see what might be worthwhile that I got that error, because you can see something we can do. So that's my active session key. We've got, this is my transfer request that I had done previously. Let me send it to Repeater. Here I'm in Repeater. And this is one that I had done previously, but this is an old session key that's already timed out. So I'm going to replace that session key with the one I just copied from my history. And let's see if we get a success here. Success, S1. So now let me try a different account number. So let me try 10. Ends in 10, go. We got success. Okay, so I just stole $1 from somebody else. Let's try 09. We get an error. Okay, we've got an error. It says E2 error. Let's go back to 10 and just make sure that things are still working. No, E2. Well, let me go to my own. No, E2. What does E2 mean? It means that it doesn't like me anymore. You're going to notice the next thing I do, it's going to say I need to log in again. Oh, need to log in again. It said, hey, wait a second. You got an error. Something ain't right here. Something ain't right. So let me hit my accounts. I'm going to check my proxy history. Can you see this? My session key has changed on me. All right? So session key has changed. I can go back into repeater, change the session key. We've got 10 as a valid account. Well, let's try incrementing. How about 12? 12, error E3, not E2, E3. Okay, and you're going to figure out success S1 with 13. So E3 indicates, well, account doesn't exist. Success is, well, success. E2 is your session key is timed out. You need to do that little login action again, right? So we now know that 13 is a good suffix and 10 is a good suffix. So we can steal some money from them, but we're limited in from this straight up transfer. You're limited in how much money you can steal, right? You're limited because let's change. We're in somebody else's. So let's do 10,000 bucks. Or that might, yeah, that's 100,000. Okay, it's exceeding how much they have in their account. We know this. They've got 1,000 in one account, 500 bucks in another account. Let's see what the error comes back with. E4. E4 is something different. So E2, your session's expired. E3, that account doesn't exist. E4, insufficient funds. That's what that means, right? So you can steal money, but you can only steal up to what they have. Well, I'm feeling particularly generous, okay? First, let me make sure that I haven't timed out. I'm just going to, you know, move a dollar from my own account. Okay, have I timed out? I'm still good. So let me try. I'm feeling particularly generous. So I would like to donate money to my good friends, well, somebody else, not me, but a valid account. So I would like to donate money. Well, you know what? On second thought, I'd like to donate negative money. I'm feeling generous, but not that generous. I donated just negative a whole crap ton of money, right? A bucket load of money. I just donated it to them. Well, negative dollars, right? So I donated negative dollars to them. And let's see how much money I've got in my account. Oh, that was nice, wasn't it? Yeah. So insufficient funds, they have a check for that. So if they didn't check for insufficient funds, then that would be a logic flaw, right? If they allowed me to take more money from someone else, if I could transfer out of my account $10,000 and send it to someone else, well, that would be a logic error too, wouldn't it? Right? Or they wouldn't allow it, and they would charge me an NSF fee, right? They would say insufficient funds, and we charge you extra money for all that extra work you made us go through now. That's just mean, right? Right. With checks, okay, I understand. Old school checks, you had some manual labor involved. With electronic transfer, that just seems a little dirty, doesn't it? Yeah, it cost us $50 of our time to not carry out that transaction for you. Really? So they don't have a logic flaw in the insufficient fund stuff, but they allow for transferring negative dollars. Now, imagine you're the developer. Imagine you're a developer. Can someone choose another account? Can someone choose an account that's not theirs? If you're the developer of the application, no. I mean, look, I'm in the application. Okay, if I want to transfer money out, I can do what? Oh, I can drop down, and that's it. So if you're a developer and you're not thinking in terms of evil, evil people on the other end, and you're not aware of things like this man in the middle and proxy, then you're thinking constrained user interface. I'm only showing them accounts that they have access to. So I don't have to worry about someone putting in a foreign account because they can't do that. Except we can, right? We can. Likewise, you know, let's say that you had just the numerics on there, right? You had a numpad that popped up when you put in your transfer. Now, ours gives us the whole keyboard, right? But you've seen applications where, in banking applications, you go in to put in a transfer. They don't pop up the whole keyboard. They pop up just the numpad. And they don't give you the option of giving negative dollars or transferring negative dollars. So, again, constrained user interface, why would a developer think about someone being able to do that or attempting that? So You know, we are looking for those kind of weirdo edge cases of giving away negative dollars, of transferring from accounts that are not our own, that are not able to be selected in the interface even. Make sense? And it doesn't have to be a mobile application to have a constrained user interface like that, right? You know, you can do a corollary in our world that's not mobile would be having client-side scripting that said, no, you can't do that. Sorry, you can't do a negative. You know, we stripped that out. Well, we might have to bypass some filter logic. Maybe the app will allow it, but the input is being filtered, or they've got client-side scripts that say, sorry, you can't do that. Yeah. So we might have to do a little bypass. We might have to do something on that front. Cool? Fun lab? I love this lab. It just makes you feel good to think that you've just stolen a lot of money from people, doesn't it? Right? It's just like, oh, that's a feel-good kind of moment, right? Just warms the heart to steal money from people, yeah? Or something like that, right? We've got another section, kind of like our JavaScript, which is a little bit of reference. It's a primer. We're not going to step through this in lengthy fashion. This class is not, you know, Python for Pencesters. It's not intended to learn you some Python. But we want to give you just an aside on the utility of having a language under your belt, but also give you a little bit of exposure. And in truth, we could choose a library that's actually much easier than the one that we've chosen, right? But we want to show you that even if you don't have really any exposure to Python, that Python is pretty readable, and we have just a simple lab where you're actually going to build out an HTTP request, send it, get the data back, right? And it's not that crazy difficult. You can look at it. Maybe you wouldn't know the syntax off the top of your head, or even with this library, but it's not crazy difficult, and you can still have some utility from it, okay? So custom scripts can be incredibly important. They can be incredibly useful. So being able to do a little bit of tool building, or honestly, not even to the extent of tool building, doing a little bit of tweaking of scripts can be worthwhile, especially when you're dealing with something that, for instance, your tool of choice doesn't accommodate well. You might need that little one-off case of building out a script. So lots of potential utility for us in web applications. And I would say this is significantly more important in web app pen testing than it is in net pen testing, to have a scripting language under your belt. And it doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to be seriously hardcore. And Python here for us, like, why are we using Python? There's no real reason. I mean, in truth, if you know any language that can interface with web applications, then that's fine, and you don't need to learn something else. So if you have a background in Ruby, right, great, good for you. If you have a background in Perl and C and in anything. But Python is very, very common. It's very commonly used. It is considered by most folks, and I would agree with this, to be an easier to learn language and an easier to read language. Like, it makes me want to punch somebody when I have to look at Ruby code. That's just me. It's just, that is, I am not, like, my background is not development, and certainly my background is not Ruby. And that's just, that is a difficult to look at language for me. For me, it is. So I personally don't think that should be someone's first language, your first exposure to a language. I feel like someone that tells you Ruby should be your first language, they're a sadist, right? Clearly. But that's, you know, if you have experience with that, then it doesn't look weird to you, and it's not off-putting to you. So it depends on familiarity. Python is considered by many to be quite readable and quite easy to learn comparatively. One of the main reasons that I would like to emphasize Python, though, is that there is a tremendous number of classes that are freely available to learn Python. I mean, there's just so much on the internet that are really high-quality classes that you can take for free to learn Python. And not just basic introductory stuff. You can take very, very advanced classes. I do have a little list collection, but really it's Coursera has a number of classes that are really good. Udacity has a number of really high quality Python classes that are available for free. And there's others, right? Google's Python class. edX. All the MOOCs, right? All the massively open online courseware, right? The little online college classes that you can take for free while someone else is paying tens of thousands of dollars a year to take classes, you know, just makes you feel good. Python is all over the place with computer science and very, very commonly used as a teaching language there. So many universities that are offering their classes in those sort of online electronic formats, they offer Python classes that you can find. So there's tons of them, absolutely tons of them out there. So Python's been around for quite some time now, early 90s. It is often installed by default on non-Windows systems, right? So Unix, Linux, Macs often have Python pre-installed, readily available, so there is a Python interpreter on there. Windows, you have to download and install Python. Now, one thing that's kind of odd is that Python 3 versus Python 2, like you would imagine, most people would expect that if Python 3, which you would assume correctly, came after Python 2, you would just assume that you would learn Python 3 from everybody. Because why would you learn the old one if Python 3 is newer? Okay, you're always going to learn the old one. That just seems to be still the case. People are primarily teaching Python 2. They are much closer than they used to be. The differences between Python 2 and Python 3 are not as pronounced as they once were. But still, most folks will have you learn Python 2 because the majority of the code out there, the majority of the tools out there are still Python 2. So variables don't have to declare and they are loosely typed. So just like with JavaScript, what this means is that you can immediately instantiate them and give them a value without having to say, hey, by the way, this is a variable. You also don't have to say what type of variable it is. In fact, with Python, you don't even have to say that it's a variable at all, which is kind of odd. All that you need it to be is an unknown anything, right? So if you just put something in the code that Python doesn't recognize as a known built-in capability, a built-in command, built-in function, then it says, oh, this must be a variable. Right, this must be something custom. So you don't even have to put var x. You can just say x equals. One of the most challenging, I think the most challenging thing about Python for people that are first learning it is that white space actually matters. That's kind of weird. Compared to most languages, white space doesn't matter at all. So tabs, spacing, carriage returns, doesn't matter at all. It's just there in most languages to increase the readability. Python, the readability, yes, the readability is part of its virtue, right? And that is enforced in some respects by this, because white space is meaningful. So check this out. We've got an if-then statement. You see, if location equals bridge of death, then there's these three questions. Yeah, what is your name? What is your quest? Okay. All right. So how can you tell that these are part of the same block of code? It's because of the spacing. Now, let's say that this one was a tab. This first one was tabbed over there. This next one was four spaces, and this next one was five spaces. I know it doesn't look like it's off, but it's off. That would mean those are actually three separate blocks of code. Right? So first one's a tab, the next one you put five spaces. It looks like it's the same, but it's not the same. And it would be actually outside of that context. So that can be challenging for folks. Really, the best answer is to use something that knows Python, because they will correct it for you. So use an IDE, and they will automatically do this for you behind the scenes. So if you just use Notepad on a Windows box, then you got to be real careful with this issue. If you use an actual development environment, something that knows Python, a GUI for building Python scripts, then it's going to automatically say, hey, wait a second, we're always going to use tab. We're always going to use four spaces, and it will convert them so that they're always the same. So just a heads up there. It's particularly important if you're taking and reusing someone else's code, right? If you're trying to do that and you're not in an integrated development environment, you're not in an IDE, you're just in like, you know, just a straight up notepad.exe on Windows, then you have to be very, very careful there. Okay. So that can be off-putting. That can be a bit weird. I am quintessential lazy slacker script kitty, right? I will cobble together code, and I always believe that I will never, ever, ever use this again. So I don't worry about readability, even for myself. I'm just like, it's like total hack fest, right? Just nothing but hacking together some code, get it working, and then I just pretend that I'm never going to look at it again. And it might as well be true, because if I ever open it up, I can't understand anything that's going on, right? There's no comments, there's no spacing, it's just all left-aligned nonsense, right? It's like I've like naturally obfuscated the code. It's just weird. Python forces me to be an easier-to-read coder, right? With the white space. So I appreciate that. Not when I'm typing it, perhaps, but I do appreciate that it forces that. It makes for readable code, or much more readable code, and that also, that is kind of a general goal of folks that use Python, write Python, is making it readable. That's like a thing. It's part of making your code Pythonic, right? Which just backhand someone if they say that your code's not Pythonic. Just go ahead. You're not going to like them anyway. They're going to annoy you. Just walk away. They're not your friend, right? But readability is actually, it's considered a virtue in Python. And that's something to be desired, which is nice for us. So we do have if-else statements. We have elif. We do not have a switch statement. You know, no big deal there. And again, look, the indentation is what makes this part of the same logical block of code, right? We have looping, of course. We have while loops. We have for loops. And again, this spacing is what matters, and the spacing is what determines that this print, right? That is part of the if block of code rather than the for block of code because of the indentation. We do have to define functions before we actually call them. So you will build out this code and then call it, with parens. Okay. One of the reasons that Python is so useful for us is that the standard library is pretty darn capable. You've likely, if you've been around the block for a little while, you've likely had to deal with code where you download the script, you're like, oh my gosh, this is going to be the best thing ever. You try to run it, and it just goes bleh all over the screen because you've got to satisfy all their little nonsense dependencies of, oh my gosh, I use this weirdo library over here, and you got to get this from CPAN, and you got to get this from over here. Well, yes, you might have to do that with Python as well, but Python standard library is pretty darn complete. And so often you will download code and you will have everything you need without even trying, which is nice. It's nice, especially for folks that are new to this. So things like regular expressions, HTML parsing, hashing, gzip compression, this is just part of standard library. So you can use this without having to download extra code, right? It makes the code much more portable without, you know, not having to satisfy all these preconditions and prerequisites. So let's see, making requests. There are many, many, many different libraries for doing this. There's hblib, urllib, urllib2, urllib3. There's one that's gotten popular lately is requests, right? So this is showing just hdplib. And the Python code that was used for user enum, remember that? User enum and find accounts? That used urllib2 to show you something different. Okay, so there are lots of different ways of doing this, but let's see. Import hblib, and that says we're going to use this. Now, Here we go. Con equals. Hold on, guys. Con equals HTTP Live.HTTP Connection. Where are you going to connect to? www.sans.org. What resource are you going to hit? So we say URL equals what we're actually going to render. Con.request, this is going to send the request. We tell it what the method is and what the resource is we want to grab, and that's now sent this request that you wanted. If you want to deal with the response, well, we've got get response function, and this will allow us to parse the response that comes back. Now, you might not have come up with this on the top of your head, right? You might not have known this, but I feel like that's pretty readable. That's pretty understandable. Just looking at those lines, and in truth, there are libraries that are even easier to use these days than HTTP Live. So, that's, to me, pretty straightforward, okay? So, interacting and dealing with files, we can use the open function, right? And we open a file using different methods. So we can read line, write, open it, we can close it, we can open it for appending to it. So we open it with a different method for depending upon what we want to do with it. If we just want to read it all in, or if we want to read it line by line, or if we want to write to it or append it, okay? So that is, in truth, sufficient building blocks for you to be able to do a little exercise. We're going to build out some Python. Now, you're going to do this Python exercise. We're going to create a script. You're going to mark it as executable. And you're going to make it so that it initiates an HTTP request. Okay? Then you're going to look at the response that comes back, and you're going to print out some header values. Okay? You're going to print out header fields and values. Then you're going to tweak the script. So this is all one script. As you flip the pages, please don't think that you have to type everything that's there. It's changing the existing script, but we do it in kind of an iterative fashion. So it's not anew having to type all those lines again. So add the HTTP request functionality. Then you're going to print header values. Now, and this is something that would be, you know, more scripted. You're going to iterate over page IDs. So you're going to hit, you know, maybe 1 through 100 or 1 through 1,000. You're going to send a whole bunch of requests, and you're going to say page ID equal 1, equal 2, equal 3. So it's kind of like just some baby step fuzzing. And then we're going to write the results of this to a file. So now it's going to, you know, send 100 requests. It's going to see what the response codes are. It's going to print out certain header fields, and you're going to write it to a file. That's a pretty significant building block for many different things that we could do. So you could have different variations upon this theme that could be quite useful. So just giving you a simple little proof of concept exercise that shows you, you know what, this is not that hardcore, it's not that off-putting, it is not that challenging to read and write this, right? And you could see some utility for even a script as simple as this one, okay? So go through that. Go through that exercise as a bonus, okay? And you can totally do this. If you know without a doubt that as soon as you're done with this class, you're never going to look at Python again, you're never going to write anything again, yep, and that's a given, then, recreate this lab. Recreate this functionality with Burp and or Zap. I would focus on Burp first, just because we haven't really spent as much time with fuzzing with Burp. We've done more with Zap, I believe. So recreate this script's functionality with Burp. Then also you could look at recreating this functionality with Zap, at least as far as sending the 100 requests and getting the responses and things like that. All right.